Live to see it. Good evening and welcome to Fast Forward Radio. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of the Speculist weblog. You can find the Speculist online at www.speculist.com. Or if you're in a big hurry and you want to go directly to the blog, you can go there by typing blog.speculist.com. At the blog and here on this show, we talk about the future. We talk about emerging technologies and emerging possibilities. We talk about a future that you'll want to live to see. Phil is here in spirit only tonight. He'll return next week. Fortunately, you won't have to hear me yakking to myself for an hour. Michael Darling is here with me. How are you tonight, Michael?
I'm good, Steven. Good evening.
Good evening to you. I hope you've had a good Easter weekend.
So far, it's been very, very good. I coach a little kids' baseball team for my oldest son and 10 other kids, and we had practice yesterday, and it was, and I warned everybody in advance, if it was wet, no matter how warm it was, we wouldn't practice. If it was below 40 degrees, we wouldn't practice. So, of course, it was 41 degrees and dry, and we froze. After that, it got
just better. It was marginal weather, but y'all toughed it out, huh?
Yeah, it was fun at the beginning, and by the end, there were these kids are mostly 8, some of them are 7, and there were some tears at the end. It was painful.
Yeah. Well, I had a good time out hunting Easter eggs and everything earlier today with my kids. As you know, I've got 4 kids, and of course, you know, they have oodles of cousins, and so we all got together and hit Easter eggs and had a good time, and so
that's fun. I got the question twice today about what does the Easter bunny, the rabbit, have to do with anything, and why do we color eggs and hide them? And both times I just went, yeah, I'll have to Google that later. I don't know, the first earthly clue.
Well, it's because it's fun. I guess I'm gonna go with
it's
fun. Yeah, obviously it's a Christian holiday, but where the Easter Bunny came in, I have no idea. I guess I'll have to find that out too. Somewhere it's written down somewhere. So
I can hardly believe that I'm 45 Easters into my life and I've never answered that question and never even
thought to ask it before. Now, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, report back to us next week. Inquiring minds
sure.
Want to know when did the Easter Bunny become part of the Easter experience for everybody? But yeah, we got a great show tonight. We don't have a regular guest, but again, it's one of those shows where the news is the guest, and tonight I'll be talking about the human brain, and to get us off on the right foot, which strangely enough involves the left hemisphere. Please help me welcome to the studio tonight 2 very special guests, Pinky and the Brain.
And now, the part of the brain, performed by the Brain.
Yes. Neocortex, frontal lobe. Hippocampus, neural node, right hemisphere. Pons and cortex visual.
Right hand.
Sylvian Fisher pineal, left hemisphere. Cerebellum left, cerebellum right. Synapse hypothalamus, striatum dendrite. Axon fibers, matter gray. Central tegmental pathway, temporal lobe. White core matter, forebrain skull.
Right stem.
Central fissure, cord spinal, parietal. Diameter, meningeal vein, medulla oblongata, and lobe limbic. Microelectrodes. The brain. That ought to keep the little squirts happy. Yeah.
Well, aside from being called little squirts, I'd say that we are happy.
Nicely done. I have to confess a true affinity for Pinky and the Brain.
Oh, yes,
and,
absolutely.
Even relevant to the topic tonight, maybe in 58 minutes or however much longer we have left to go, we'll be able to come back and confirm or deny that basically Brain's description proves we have vocabulary for pretty much the whole structure and the whole layout, but that's about it.
Well, you know, it's new, you know, it's near, this show is near and dear to my heart, Pinky and the Brain, because, you know, well, if it weren't for Phil and now your hijinks, I would have long ago taken over the world. But y'all kept me from it, and so there you go. But anyway.
Well, I don't want to deviate on Pinky and the Brain too far, but I want to point out two things. One, I think in more than one episode, they actually do successfully take over the world. But then for whatever reason,
they can't hold on to it. For whatever
they can't hang on to it. That's right. So there's that. And I think there is an episode, and I, man, you're challenging my memory, and this is something we're going to talk about for sure. But I think there's an episode where they take over the world and don't know it. So and what I'm saying here, Stephen, is that it's possible you have taken over the world, and you just aren't aware
of it. I just don't remember it. Okay.
That's right.
Well, that will help me sleep better tonight, I'm sure. But in all seriousness, if for any reason any member of our audience needs to learn the parts of the brain, check out the video of what I just played. you will be brain farmed. You will never again forget any part of the brain. He's pointing to each part as he sings that song. And, you know, if you're in med school or whatever, I highly recommend it. But anyway, it's pretty funny. But anyway, we want to get into our more serious topics tonight. And as I said earlier, Phil is here in spirit, and here's why. Our source material tonight for tonight's show is the 33rd edition of Phil's Better All the Time series at The Speculist. And if you happen to be listening to us live or even on delay, you can find that at The Speculist, of course, and kind of follow along with us if you care to. There is no possibility that we're going to be able to cover all the topics that he covered in the show tonight, but we're going to give it a try. And
well, the lead up there in this rendering of Better All the Time, Phil either remembered or went and hacked up a nice quote from Thomas Edison that said, "The chief function of the body is to carry the brain around."
I like that. I like that. And from our point of view, that's absolutely true. I mean, the seat of our personhood is our brains, right? And so the rest of the body just sort of serves to, you know, get us around, to feed the brain, to do everything that the brain needs to do.
I'd say it's more involved than carrying it around. But if by carry it around you also imply provide sensory stimulation and new experience and a way to accomplish all the other body functions we need to accomplish, then yes, I would go along with that. Although I will say that in the biggest picture, I'm not so sure that the brain in isolation can be said to be sort of the core or, you know, the real repository of us. I think it's more of a collective thing, although people have their legs amputated, and I wouldn't argue that's not them. That's still them, and their brain still functions, and I don't know how to address that.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a whole different way of looking at it. Evolutionists would say, or scientists that are biologists that study evolution, would say that the human brain is just a tool to aid the survival of human DNA. It was just a survival experiment that went with unexpected results. You know,
so the smarter we got, the better able we were to not only procreate but survive.
Right. Well, I mean, in the battle of tooth and claw, we were at a disadvantage. We didn't have great teeth or claws for defending or attacking, but we were given this great gift in our brains.
But it turns out we can animate little cute cartoon mice that do funny things, and somehow that evolutionarily that aids us. I don't get it.
Well, it keeps us from getting too bored, I guess.
There's that.
Anyway, but it turns out that the brain started out as kind of a survival experiment that went unexpectedly right, I guess, or wrong, depends on how you look at it. But anyway, let's go in and get into our topics. Let me address this. If you accept, you know, that our brains are a result of, evolutionary biology, it seems to me that you get the technological singularity thrown in for free. And what I mean by that is, up until this point, our brains are the result of an undirected process.
Undirected by us, anyway.
Undirected by us, exactly.
Right.
And so, at this point, though, you know, we you know, by whatever means, we decide to push it in different directions. You know, what can result? Well, if we even make ourselves just a little bit smarter, or we create tools that are just a little bit smarter, then that's the singularity. And so it seems to me that the singularity kind of comes for a ride when you're looking at evolution in the broadest sense. So
I think you're right about that. I think the characterization lines up and is coherent. I think it also begs the question of if from an evolutionary point of view, the brain is there for us to survive. And it's done pretty well at that so far, at least, I mean, we have survived, then in the singularity, in the transition to singularity or post-singularity environment, if we don't survive, you say, yeah, from an evolutionary point of view, that whole brain consciousness thing, it worked for a while, but in the end, it failed.
Or there something else that was more intelligent that basically drove out, you know, human level intelligence,
or better able to survive. I mean, you know, it's the cockroaches take over the world after the nuclear holocaust theory, right? We got so smart we blew ourselves up, and the cockroaches end up with everything.
Yeah, so that the ultimate result is, well, that experiment just didn't work out. I'm on the side of intelligence working out, so.
So far, I mean,
so
I'd rather it work than not work, for sure.
Let's keep this positive, Michael.
Yeah.
But you're right. Yeah, I want to open up the lines to callers. If anybody's listening, you know, those who are listening live want to call in, the number is 347-215-8972. And we're going to be visiting about all kinds of brain-related topics. And so
before we even get to the first topic, the first number one, if you will, one other thing I wanted to throw out, and it doesn't really have a lot of obvious relevance, except that every time I find myself reading about the brain or thinking about the brain, I come back to this notion, and it's this. And admittedly, the numbers here I'm going to estimate, because I don't think there is a quantifiable, proven number that says, here's how many synapses are in the human brain.
Right.
But let's just say 3 trillion. Now, I can find sources that say a quadrillion or, you know, plus or minus, but, you know, somewhere in the trillions is probably the number, at least based on what our information is now. But stars in the Milky Way, likewise unknowable, somewhere in the 1 to 200 billion range. In other words, there's 10 times as many synapses in the human brain as there are stars in the Milky Way. In and of itself,
that's mind-blowing.
It is. It gets me going to the point where I'm like, okay, and yet that 3 trillion synapses are all in something the size of, well, not even the size of a bowling ball.
Yeah.
You know, it's to me, that's a difficult little fact to gnaw on, and then I think about, yeah, well, it's the interaction between neurons that is a synapse. By definition, the synapse is the space between, and yet, it's that space between that we think is where basically what happens happens. And when I say what happens, I mean we're thinking, our brain is functioning. But on the other hand, here's the Milky Way, and there's, you know, a tenth as many stars, and they're so much further apart. It's like, what kind of interaction could they possibly have?
Yeah.
Albeit, they obviously must be interacting at some level.
Well, it's, you know, it's amazing to me. We live in such an incredible universe, and, you know, with things around us that are fantastic in every direction and in every way. But the most complex and most amazing thing that I think that humans haven't yet encountered is our own minds, and that in itself is a pretty cool point, isn't it?
So it is, and that. I brought up the quantity, the just raw numbers, for a reason. The first thing that Phil pointed to was that the brain actually can keep growing.
Right.
You know, commonly held myth or commonly held knowledge, common knowledge was that after a certain period of time, your brain stops growing and you're not growing new neurons. In fact, they're just dying a few at a time or thousands at a time or whatever for some length of time. And now it appears that that may not be as true as is commonly held. Two thoughts come to my mind right away. One, if your brain, if the actual quantity of neuron, whether it's because individual neurons are getting bigger or neurons are multiplying, if they're getting bigger, how does your brain, which already fits in your skull in a fairly compact way, continue to fit in your skull over the life, over the course of your lifetime?
I have to profess ignorance on that, but you know, there is one obvious fact that you know that would point to the fact that the brain is malleable for a long, long time, and that is that old people can learn stuff. I mean, you know, I've got a neighbor down the street here who, at age 80, got her doctorate. You know, I mean, it seems to me it's pretty obvious from just general experience that the brain doesn't. You know, I mean, it's true that there, you know, there is some dropping off, and then by age, there's a certain age at which, you know, maybe 1 in 10 people have some serious brain deficiency, you know, after say age 80 or so. But even at advanced ages, if those diseases like Alzheimer's haven't shown up, then people can continue to do remarkable things.
It's the it's that second notion about, and it's contained in that first part of the things are getting better all the time, that in fact the plasticity, the flexibility or the malleability of the human brain is still there.
Right.
Despite age, despite longevity into adulthood, and the implication being not only can you learn things, but you can think about things in a new way, you can still be creative, all of which is very encouraging. My fear is that that memory, and that it's not being able to recall things, and so I think to myself, well, it's not going to do me that much good to learn a bunch of new things or to, quote, know things that I can't recall. And it's, that's to me, that's the classic joke about the brain function and aging, where, you know, the two things that go as you get older are, one is memory, and the other one is I can't remember.
Yeah, and the other one's memory loss. Yeah, exactly. Well, it's, and obviously, as you get older, I think one of the things that I noticed that, older members of my family have tended to do is that, you know, they find that they want, in order to stay sharp, they engage in things that, you know, it becomes more important to them to, stay involved with, like, their social groups, church or whatever. If they have a regular card game or something like that, it becomes, kind of a religious thing to them almost. In order to, I think, keep sharp. And it's, I guess it's one of those things, if you don't use it, you'll lose it. And,
it might be a desire to keep sharp. It might also be that that not unlike, you know, the proverbial scratching the itch, that doing certain things or being active in certain ways stimulates the brain in a way that just feels good.
Right.
And
right.
You go, I have this urge to do it. And I'm, you know, you mentioned cards, but I was already thinking about how I had just read recently that the CEO of Bear Stearns last weekend, when Bear Stearns was, unbeknownst to the most of the world, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and the Secretary of the Treasury were working, burning the midnight oil, trying to figure out what to do with Bear Stearns, which was about to fail, came up with the rescue plan that was announced Monday morning, and, hey, here's J.P. Morgan to the rescue, and Federal Reserve guarantees this, and it's a pretty big deal in the banking world. Well, the CEO of Bear Stearns was at a bridge tournament over the weekend. Now, it could be that he was playing bridge or fiddling as Rome burned because he knew there was nothing he could do all weekend anyway. He'd already seen the handwriting on the wall, and it's like, whatever rescue plan they come up with, I'm going to have to accept it because, you know, what more could I do? But it also occurred to me, it may just be that despite the fact that his company was in dire straits, I mean, the most dire straits that an institution of that kind can be in. He just couldn't resist the impulse to be in this bridge tournament and playing at a high level.
Yeah. I think you're exactly right. It could be both, though. I mean,
You're right. I guess, make it mutually exclusive. There's no need for that to be the case.
That's right. And so, I guess we'll report back to the our Fast Forward radio listeners when we pass a certain age. Let everybody know what it's like to, why cards and dominoes are so important to you.
The thing about that notion that for intellectual stimulation, doing things that, even that aren't useful or that in the bigger picture, everybody would sort of agree is maybe not that efficient or productive, yet you can't resist. I never got hooked by computer games and video games.
Yeah.
And I know people who have. I don't know too many people who've gone the route of they were losing weight, they're pale, they got the twitch, they got the all the stuff. That was
lost
never
their job.
That was never it for me. I mean, I'm sure there's people out there like that. And I was like, yeah, what is it about that intellectual stimulation that draws them? Now, for me, it's something a little bit, in a way, more complicated, but in a way, much more basic. I just wanted facts. I wanted to go to the library and roam around and grab stuff off the shelves that just looked interesting, flip through it for a few minutes, even though it had nothing to do with anything.
Yeah, yeah.
Or anything relevant, to what I was trying to accomplish in my life. I mean, it made it very hard to get through university, I can tell you that.
Yeah, because, it always seems that the most interesting thing in the world is the thing that you're not working on at that moment. I'm with you. I was there. That's exactly the problem I had when I was going through college. But managed to make it through anyway. I guess I deadlines motivated me. I finally would, get it together at the last minute. I always
deadlines have a way of getting things done. that is one area, and we're going to talk about this one further down the list, where meditation and the ability to grow parts of the brain, but really areas of the brain associated with focus and concentration. Man, pair those up with the ability to be disciplined enough to make a deadline, and you've got a very high-functioning brain.
Yeah. Well, let's get to item number two. We're well into the show, and we got so far to go. And, again, we're not going to make it through, but I want to get it through a number of topics. So let's get to item number two. New findings about the brain lead to treatment for eating disturbances. And basically, let me just get into it real quick. It's discovery of this brain's so-called melanocortin system and its central role in controlling appetite. Apparently, defects in this system have led some people to become very fat, and then other defects in the system have caused other people to be anorexic. And they feel like if we can understand the system well enough to design a drug that will, it would help dangerously thin people get bigger, and dangerously big people to get littler. And so,
seems like a good thing.
Yeah, seems like a good thing.
Always on the watch out for
unintended
consequence,
exactly.
But it does seem like a good thing.
Yeah, yeah. If you start dealing with a complex system like the brain, there's always unintended consequences. You just hope that the unintended consequences are minor enough that it doesn't undo the good that you're trying to do, and so in some way, and so yeah, that's for everyone who's having some difficulty in the modern world keeping the weight off, then that's promising, and so.
Well, if it addresses what I think of as the broader question, why we either eat quantity or quality of things that, you can call them food, and I'm gonna use some examples here by referencing brand names that you and I will know in common, like Cheetos.
Yeah.
I love Cheetos. I don't understand why, because they're not really food. There's really no food value, but I love Cheetos. And
it's a vegetable. Corn.
Yeah. One could only wish.
In the broadest sense, it's food. Come on, give yourself a break.
If this understanding of the melanocortin and how the brain regulates appetite and what we eat and how much we eat can also address the question of, why do I like Cheetos? why do we like any kind of food that really has no food value? Now, sugar water is a different thing because, yeah, it maybe doesn't have food value, but the stimulative value in and of itself is something. But, man, the whole thing about what we eat and how we eat, it's utterly mysterious to me.
Well, without getting too deep into the low carb debate, I would suggest to you that the sugar water and the Cheeto have a lot in common once it hits your bloodstream.
Yep, I think there's some truth to that.
Okay, item number three, hacking your brain. You want to lead off with this one, Michael?
I love this idea. In fact, I know Phil used the nice Matrix reference where Neo learns Kung Fu. There's another moment where the female character in Matrix needs to learn how to fly a helicopter. And so from within their reality, they're talking back to the guy at the mothership who is, what kind of helicopter is it? And Neo's looking at her like, what are you doing? And she's like, well, I got to learn how to fly that helicopter. And he goes, do you know how to fly that helicopter? She's like, not yet, and starts walking toward it. And he basically reprograms her, you know, in the 20 steps it takes her to walk to it. She's like, I can now. Let's go.
That would be pretty cool.
Great idea. I think even reading the article, the Peskovitz work, about what he's thinking is conceivable or conceptually possible, I would reference another and he's not so much a neurologist as he is a performance coach, if you will. The man's name is George Leonard.
Yeah.
He wrote a book called Mastery, and the concept of mastery in the book was really just how do people get really, really good at doing something? And where he talks about you have to practice, you have to start an activity, you practice it, and initially you might be much, much better than you shortly thereafter will become. And then you practice at that plateaued level for a long time, and then you move to a new plateau. You might have a dramatic improvement, you might have a gradual improvement, but you get to a new plateau, and you practice there. And he makes the argument, I think he makes it pretty convincingly, that there's a relationship between the mind and body, or a cause and effect, and you need to reinforce that. There's both a temporal component and a... Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
And a repetitious component that they have to interact in a kind of subtle way for that mastery to emerge. The implication being that you really couldn't just know it. And although I won't make the claim that I know how to play the piano, but conceptually I get what a piano is. I can look at the keys. I can look at the thing. I understand what it's trying to do, but that doesn't allow me to actually sit down and play the piano.
Right. Right.
Although apparently that's what Mozart did.
Well, and again, he had a brain that was operating at a different level, at least musically.
Yep.
And the idea that this could actually come about, hacking a brain, this is something that's being put forward by David Peskovitz, co-editor of BoingBoing.net and research director with the Institute for the Future. Anyway. I mean, it's his thought that, I mean, at some point we could actually be able to do that. I think I would say that's still a few years in the future because I don't, there's so much we need to understand before we can actually start patching the brain or hacking the brain to that extent. But
I think this goes also to the idea that that the time could come where you take a pill to learn German.
Would be awesome, wouldn't it?
You're a fully functioning English speaker. You go, hey, I'm going to India for a couple of weeks. The language spoken in the area I'm going is this language. You pop the pill, you learn that language.
And the question then, is it a permanent, thing, or does it fade after a while?
I mean, frankly, yeah. I mean,
it wouldn't matter, would it?
Exactly. It's like I kind of don't care if I didn't remember after I left.
Yeah, you can always pop the pill later when you go back. So
or you maybe would intentionally take a pill, and I know this was actually something that Phil posted on, or perhaps you did, last year on the Speculist, that were neurologists were working on a drug that incidentally, they didn't set out with this as the goal, but it incidentally had the effect of actually eliminating short-term memories. And you'd start thinking about, well, what kind of a situation would I want to eliminate a memory? I mean, it's not eternal sunshine.
It's not hard to come up with a few ideas. What if you could what if you could give that to a person who had just been raped? You know,
And you might not want to give it to that person initially because you want to collect evidence.
Yeah.
Their memory might be the best hope for that, but at some point you say, hey, there's maybe some memories that I would choose not to have.
Right, exactly.
The other thing that I would say about the Peskovitz article, he references the fact that humans have used caffeine and other drugs to alter our states of mind, which, you know, he goes on to make the broader point in the idea of the hackable mind, and if we could come up with a more drug-based or chemical-based, substance-based way to learn how to play the piano or do whatever. But it reminds me that this idea that why don't we have the easy-on, easy-off mind-altering drug? I mean, we have alcohol and we have all sorts of illegal drugs and all sorts of other substances that people abuse. But given that we know that there's this sort of human impetus to alter how the mind is functioning or doing whatever it's doing, why don't we just come up with something that's safe and it's easy to start and it's easy to turn off?
Yeah, absolutely. I would suggest too, that's one way it's going to go, you know, one possibility.
I mean, in my social circles, we, at least when I was younger, we mostly drank socially. It was alcohol. And even it's the logical conclusion at the last call when it's like, yeah, this was a lot of fun, but now none of us can drive.
Why don't
we turn this off?
Pop a pill and
right.
within 5 minutes you're sober and you can take the wheel.
That's exactly right.
It would be a wonderful thing.
I defy Seagram's or Schweppes or any of the other major alcohol distributors to. I'll give them that idea for free.
Yeah. And incidentally, it would take away the hangover, too. There you go. That's the perfect...
Absolutely.
Is a pill that the market is there.
And not for nothing, either would eliminate the possibility of the really boneheaded judgment call or would eliminate the memory of that particular, you know, misjudgment.
Hey, Harvey in the chat room responds to what we were just talking about. We'll need human lab rats for some of this. I think Harvey would sign up. let's all go down to the bar and then we'll try the pill afterwards and see if it sobers us up. If you'd like to call in, the number is 347-215-8972. Let's get on down to item number 4 on our list. This is virus infection battles brain cancer. Okay, now this is interesting to me for a number of reasons. Let me just get into it. Curing a disease by causing another one seems counterintuitive, but there you have it. Scientists at Yale are trying to do it, and actually have done it in lab rats. And so they have a lab rat that has what would amount to an inoperable brain cancer in a human. This lab rat has it. They give it this virus that's been modified, and 3 days later the tumors are gone. Now, this is interesting, but I think this is something that initially would be tried on someone who is, hope is gone otherwise.
I think even in the article they point out that both from a stage of technology or stage of what the research indicates and from a medical ethics point of view, you basically are dealing with people who have exhausted all of their hope.
Right.
And when you're talking about people. Now, when you're talking about rats or pinky in the brain, you go for it. But
well, pinky anyway.
Hey, now, wait a minute. I actually think that the punchline with pinky in the brain of one of them's a genius and one of them's insane is that you can make the argument very strongly.
It can go either way.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm not saying, don't experiment on pinky. That's what he's there for. But
that's great.
And he wouldn't mind, frankly.
The
thing about viruses, they are wicked cool.
Yeah.
I agree with you on this. The article, I think the quote is, they're tough, they're relentless. Both these things appear to be true. On the other hand, they're small, and they're a little scary because I think and I might get the number wrong.
Viruses have their own agenda sometimes, don't they?
Yeah, I think the average virus, most viruses are like 20 to 400 nanometers. I mean, they're little tiny things that we don't necessarily have full grasp of how to manipulate their environment in a way that we can say that we are actually controlling them.
There's another issue. The human brain doesn't have an immune system at all. And you start introducing viruses into a part of the body that does not have any ability to fight off an infection. I just wonder, you know, I mean...
it's a valid question.
Yeah, so, you know, hopefully they do exactly what we program them to do, and then they don't do anything else. And maybe for someone who's, you know, on death's door anyway, why not give it a shot? But, again, this is... it's sort of a heroic last ditch kind of deal.
It's one of those things, and I know I've read far too much science fiction, but it's I've read far too much bad science fiction. But it's one of those things where I'd want the team in the lab that are doing this to have the fail-safe, foolproof way of taking the population of viruses from whatever it is they make it to. Trying to eat the brain cancer back down to zero,
yeah.
So that you don't end up with this. Hey, we did this virus and it kind of got away from us, and now they're all over the place, and we don't really know what the impact is going to be in the broader environment. Yeah, I wouldn't want that.
Yeah, got to be careful about that stuff.
Yep.
Okay, let's go to item number five. A single brain cell's power is shown. Now, I don't know that I necessarily buy this one. And I'll explain to you why. According to this article that Phil points out in the Better All the Time that he just wrote, there could be enough computing ability in just one brain cell to allow humans and animals to feel, the study suggests. The brain has 100 billion neurons, but scientists had thought that they needed to join forces in larger networks to produce thoughts and sensations. So the European group of scientists gets together, they stimulate one rat neuron, and it could deliver the sensation of touch somehow. Well, I've got some questions. That rat neuron was not sitting in a petri dish in isolation. It's in the rat brain, and you stimulate that one rat neuron, and you may be stimulating the whole brain. You know, I mean, because again, that rat neuron is sitting within the network. You know,
more to the point. I mean, and I'm sure they feel like their data is verifiable, but how do you really know what the rat felt? Forget for a minute, you don't really know where the signal went once it was in that one neuron. How do you know what the rat felt?
Yeah. I mean, did the rat report back? I guess it's something we just need to read a little closer, because maybe in our ignorance we don't know. We're criticizing in ways that they've already answered, but it just seems to me that that's one I'd have to read the study closer before I could actually buy into it.
Yeah, I'm with you there, and I think the broader implication, forget for a minute whether or not this research really demonstrates the point in an effective way, but the broader implication is that even a single neuron has significant capability, whether it's processing capability or transmission capability, it has significant functionality that by understanding it in its isolation or as a single neuron could be revealing in the bigger picture. Now, I don't know if it was Phil or the article, but on this number five, the single neuron function, I think Phil was drawing the conclusion that this says that the really big brain breakthroughs are yet to come, which I think is true, and will probably be coming much sooner than most of us suspect. Well, I think that's true. I don't think the single neuron rat feeling study demonstrates that. I do think it's true that it's going to be sooner than we think, because I think when it happens and we start getting the big breakthroughs, I think it's going to happen. It's going to be exponential. It's like Tuesday we didn't know anything, and by Friday we know almost everything.
Yeah, and the other thing is that society at large really has no idea what's going on behind the scenes, and I don't mean that in an elitist any kind of way.
No, I don't either.
But because I'm part of that, I'm not a scientist by trade. I'm just a guy out in the normal population that happens to take an interest in this stuff. But it's you know, it's kind of a situation where we don't know exactly what's happening in within the fields, and truth be known, those that are within those fields don't know what's happening in the very in a neighboring area of science.
Or they've totally dismissed it, and they say, "Hey, our approach to modeling neurological function is the only valid approach," and they kind of narrow in on it, and then they rule out some other approach, or they rule out all the other data. And they're, not only are they not aware of it, they're consciously choosing to avoid it. I mean, it's like I don't want to know what that guy's up to.
And then some maverick comes along and puts it all together in a way that no one ever thought about, and all of a sudden, bam, it's overnight. It seems
sometimes.
Like, yeah, that you have a revolution. So that's pretty cool. This, I think, item number six in this Better All the Time is my personal favorite.
Mine too, but I bet you for different reasons.
Well, let's find out. Tiny brain-like computer created. All right, and what does that mean? The most powerful computer known is the brain, and now scientists have designed a machine just a few molecules large that mimics how the brain works. So, at any rate, so neurons are not connected to, you know, like in a serial capacity. They are connected in many different ways. My understanding is that this new device that they're creating, which is different from a transistor, completely different from a transistor, could at some point become a device that would be a thousand times more operations than a transistor at the same size. And so,
this makes it to the top of your cool factor list for this particular list because,
well, I mean, it's another example of how I'm not necessarily afraid of the end of Moore's law. Okay, the ability to shrink transistors at some point is going to run up against a molecular wall. They're not going to be able to get any. You know, you can't create a transistor smaller than an atom. You know. And so, what do you do? Well, you gotta build something else, and this is an example of a possibility. And you know, it seems like we're hearing all the time about new. You know, if it's not this, it's a quantum computer, or you know, there are lots of different ways to beat Moore's law and continue to push computation forward, in spite of the fact that transistors can't get too much smaller than they are.
So maybe we do make this our favorite one for the same reason. My reason is just because the thing is so dang small.
Yeah.
What they're talking about is 17, and I'm gonna blow the pronunciation, but that's okay.
Yeah.
Duraquinone molecules, where you have one surrounded by 16 of these molecules. And the idea is that, and they make this comparison in the article, that if you had a spider web with a spider in the middle and 16 strands of the web, the spider stepping in one direction or another would result in a slightly different tug or motion on all 16 strands, and it's that interaction of these 17 molecules that is actually the computational power and device. But the molecule itself is, I mean, this is whatever you want to, however you want to characterize the rest of it, this is basic nanotechnology to be able to manipulate these things that are nanometers big. They're
right.
Less than a billionth of a meter. They're you know, not visible. I also like it for this reason, although this is more trivial than anything I understand in an academic or useful way, but they build it on a surface of gold. And I thought, wow, that's one of the few industrial applications of gold I actually know about. Although, if you think about it, it's you know, the thing is less than a nanometer, and you're going to put 17 of them. You don't need all that much gold to assemble the device.
Actually, gold is one of those things that is used quite a bit in devices like this. I'm not sure exactly why, but
it's shiny
and it's pretty. Yeah, but
the point is, it is insanely small. And if you read the article, they talk about the guys who built this thing or are working with this technology are talking about being able to ramp up relatively quickly to computational capabilities that are somewhat staggering, if it works.
Yeah.
So it's one of these things where they're not going to be doinking around with it for 6 or 10 years going, well, maybe. No, in the next 6 quarters, in the next year and a half or so, they're either going to have something that is wicked cool and very powerful, or they're not going to have anything at all.
Well, let's keep our fingers crossed on that one. I guess we should point out why this one was included with, or at least emphasize why this was included in the Better All the Time that has to do with the human brain. Well, this is very much like the neuron. I think I may have said this earlier, but this device is more like a neuron than a transistor is today, and it connects in ways that transistors don't. And so, you know, in the past, modeling things after nature hasn't always worked out for us. Phil mentioned the early flying machines that were modeled after flapping wings of birds didn't work out. And instead, we eventually learned that fixed wings were better for what we needed to do. I think there's some truth to that. We need to learn what makes the human brain work, and use those ideas in creating our machines the best we can, and go in different ways when it turns out that the different ways are better. But I think the human brain has a lot to teach us in that way.
I think if the model here says this one functions more like a neuron than a computer chip or than other computational devices, in and of itself, that's interesting. And if you can put 100 billion of them in close enough proximity that they can interact and start to create their network of synapses, if you will, then it gets very interesting. Because now you get to a point where you have sort of modeled something very, in terms of structure and interaction or how that functions, you do have something that's kind of like the human brain.
Well, I would suggest to you, if we're going to do something like that, we need to figure out a way to make it self-assembling, the way the human brain is self-assembling. Can you imagine trying to manufacture something, putting something together like that?
No.
It just wouldn't work. So,
no.
Self-assembly, I think, is going to, that's a field of science that's going to be extremely important in nanotech and in this kind of, building our computers or whatever, Anyway, let's get to item number 7. And this is interesting to me. Meditation found to increase brain size. Now, again, this is another issue with, the skull's your limiting factor, right? If you really mean that. I think though what they mean is that, it's, again, there's evidence that the brain is malleable, or, your ability to learn and things has actually improved by meditation. So,
part of me reacted to this with the obvious American punchline that, somehow it matters.
Yes, size
and
matters.
This is a good thing.
Yeah.
On the other hand, the article really talks about how it's really certain areas of the brain that in fact develop or appear to develop, and the areas that they were focused on or the areas they were looking at are areas that happen to correlate with focus and concentration. And those to me seem like really good things to be able to say, hey, this can get better. You can be better able to focus or have better concentration, if you exercise in this way, and that exercise or that practice happens to be meditation.
Right. And that makes sense. That's what are you attempting to do when you meditate? Well, I would suggest that one of the things you're doing is focusing, And so I would suggest that's kind of an obvious thing, that if you, something that you do a lot, your brain will adapt to that activity, and there will be a difference in your brain as a result.
Not unlike the Cheeto experiment, where I wish I could eat Cheetos and get have better abs and a more fit physical existence. I would have hoped. And I have nothing against meditation, but I would have thought, and maybe still think, that if practicing focus or practicing concentration allows you to better able to focus and concentrate, it doesn't necessarily seem like the logic is there that meditation, a form of meditation where you're clearing your mind and consciously trying to focus on not focusing on anything or not thinking about anything, would make you better able to focus any better than, say, reading the newspaper. I'm focused on reading the newspaper. I'm focused on watching Pinky and the Brain, and I practice concentrating and focusing there and get better at concentration and focus. But having watched a lot of cartoons and read a lot of newspapers, I can tell you that my own personal subjective opinion is that doesn't work as well.
Well, it's something that does work that I've noticed, well, in my experience as a student, for example, is that the better I got as a student, the better I got as a student. You know what I'm saying? For example, I didn't really apply myself much in high school. Got through it, you know. But once I got to college, got out on my own and started taking an interest in, you know, in bettering myself, I would get in there and begin to study, and I learn practices and learn routines to learn. Okay, and as I learned to learn, I would get better and better at it. And it seemed like throughout my college years, especially, I became a better and better student. But I became better at the process of learning because of just the fact that I was in there doing it.
I think that does make sense, and I'm perhaps trying to go with the more extreme example that I practiced focusing by watching Pinky and the Brain really intently, and then I was hoping to focus better in other areas of my life. But
yeah,
it seems like it's not really just a quantitative thing. How many hours a day do you spend in deep concentration or in deep focus on one thing? It's not just quantity; it is quality. And if you spend that time focused on something, how shall we say, entertaining or trivial, as opposed to, and I don't want to use the word more important, but something more qualitatively able to train your mind to focus and concentrate, it seems to make a difference.
Harvey is describing meditation here. He says, empty the mind. Picture leaves on the pond floating away. Each leaf is a thought. Okay. I've never practiced meditation, so I don't want to dismiss anyone who has done it and has found that it worked for them. I'm not surprised that it would work. Again, it's one of those things that as you would do it, I suppose you'd get better and better at it. And I'm not really surprised that a brain scan would show differences in between those who meditate and those who don't. Things do happen. Your brain does adapt to whatever activities you're engaging in. So, I think that's
an interesting study all the same that takes a functional MRI approach to what's going on with people meditating both before, after, and can conclude or start to draw pictures and maybe create a path towards understanding the brain better. That was interesting.
I want to combine number 8 and 9 on Phil's list real quickly because I want to get through them, and we're about to run out of time.
Well, you kind of combined them too.
Yeah.
Because it's, why don't you summarize them, and then you tell me if you think they're all that different.
Okay, brain scanner can tell, number 8, brain scanner can tell you what you're looking at. Article says basically, tell me what you see. On second thought, don't. This brain scan, you can look at something, the brain, and we got brain scanning now down to such a precise level that the computer can determine what you're looking at based on the brain scan. That is pretty cool. You got mind reading computers now. I think that's pretty cool. And number 9. The next one, brain-computer interfaces for manipulating dreams. Well, why do I think that they're very similar? Obviously, when it comes to brain-computer interfaces, I would prefer a brain scan than something that has to jack into my brain through my skull. You know what I'm saying? I would rather have the brain cap than the jack that they show in the Matrix. You know what I'm saying?
It may be
the skull cap is preferable.
The picture at the bottom of that article has sort of the tinfoil helmet appearance to it.
Yeah.
But
cooler.
But much cooler.
Yeah.
Much cooler. Much more streamlined. Much more. It's not tinfoil, but you know what I'm saying. It's the hat.
Yeah.
But even at that point, I think Well, yeah, if you could actually see what somebody was thinking about and correlate it to a visual image that somebody else can see the visual image and not have to communicate with that individual in an overt way, doesn't it sort of replace the lie detector?
Yeah, absolutely. It seems to me that an unbeatable lie detector could be developed from brain scans that are that detailed.
I mean, not for one second do I think that would be the initial commercial application. I think it would be somehow related to pornography or some other more entertainment-related sales approach. But
right.
From a technology, it seems like, yeah, to be able to look and go, this is what somebody's thinking, and actually have a visual image of it, that is huge. I don't like so much the idea, and number 9 sort of implied this more than 8, that you would then create a interface for manipulating the dream state. I don't see the need for it, but this could be me thinking, yeah, dreams are what they are, but they're not especially relevant to cognitive function other than knowing that, hey, the brain is in fact functioning and the dreams occur as a result.
You know, he mentions in number 9 lucid dreaming. Michael, have you ever had lucid dreams? Yeah. And number 1, do you know what a lucid dream is?
Let's agree on our definition here.
Okay.
If by lucid dreaming you mean I as the first
dream.
Person point of view dreamer in the dream, know I'm dreaming and alter the dream environment as a result.
Correct. You realize you're
yes.
dreaming and say, let's have some fun with this. And,
yes.
And you alter your dream to do whatever it is you want to do. You've
yes.
done that before. Okay.
Yes, I have.
Good. Then we have a common frame of reference. I'm able to accomplish that probably every 3 or 4 months.
I think if you focused on it, you could accomplish it a lot more. My prediction is that even when you do it, while it's cool, it's not especially useful.
Well, I tell you, it's useful to me in this sense. Whenever I wake up after a night of being able to dream lucidly like that, I am in a fantastic mood, and I mean, I am so productive on days following lucid dreaming. It's incredible to me. I'm operating on a different level after that. I don't know what it is.
I take that back. Then you should focus and try and do it more often.
I guess so. I don't know what it is. It's an uplifting experience. Harvey in the chat room is talking about meditation is like a lucid nap. Well, maybe I should try meditation too. You know, if it's such a positive experience, lucid dreaming, then maybe I need to do both more often.
I would say that most forms of meditation do not have as one of the desired goals that you actually enter a sleep state, that you in fact are awake and perhaps even more conscious or lucid than you are otherwise, but while awake, but under no circumstances is the objective to actually fall asleep. Although I think that falling asleep is a common byproduct when you start to learn.
Well, we are out of time, Michael. I hate to cut it off so abruptly, but we just are. I want to point everybody to everything we talked about tonight is in the newest Better All the Time feature at The Speculist, and Phil wrote that all by himself, and so he was our absent guest this evening. Phil was, and so get to The Speculist and read everything we've talked about tonight. I'll also in the show notes I'll get a from YouTube. I'll pull in the Pinky and the Brain. a video, so you can learn the parts of the brain if that's important to you. If it's not, well, then it ought to be.
Narf.
And we've had a good time this evening, and hope to see. Well, have everybody back this time next week. We do have some great exit music, to me, I had kind of hoped to keep this exit music until we actually talked about this subject, but it's about the space elevator, and so I'm looking, you know, you're going to love it, and I probably will dust this one off and play it again some night that we're talking about that subject. So, anyway, enjoy, and had a great show. Michael, appreciate it.
Adios.
All righty. Good night.